Welcome to the Brilliant Podcast. I believe this is going to be episode either 93 or 94. And this episode, I'm actually going to do something that I'm sure I'll be made fun of, but my friend Obsidian here is going to, in fact, interview me in the context of talking about the book that I just recently released. You can find it at littleblackcart.com. You can also find it at thefightfor.land or something like that. Anyways, the book is called The Fight for Turtle Island, and we're going to talk about, I'll read the back cover here. As a place that doesn't exist, but did, Turtle Island is the type of no place usually referred to as a myth. Perhaps this is true. Perhaps Turtle Island is merely the fantastic story of a people who have since disappeared. Or it's the story I'd prefer to tell about the place that I live. If I live in Turtle Island and not the United States of America, I can differentiate between my life and the life violently imposed upon me. I might be powerless to do much about it, but it somehow feels important to assert that I would if I could. Not an end of the movie inspirational assertion about how we are powerful together, but a personal declaration that I am not on the side of the myth, that I'm on the side of myth versus manifest destiny. That I believe in something like struggle, if not the particulars of a specific fight. That I walk on the back of turtles and not on the spinning globe that'll soon be discarded when the powerful are ready to leave. So, Obsidian, you've taken notes, you've read at least the introduction, and you heard my presentation last night. Yeah. It's now your show.
Well, you know, the book did just come out, and I know you've been working on it for a few years, and I've been eagerly anticipating it. Because it did just come out, I've only had time to read the introduction and the conclusion.
Oh, you read the conclusion.
I can't wait to delve into the interviews. You know, I recognize a lot of the people you interviewed, Gord Hill, Clee from Blackfire, and of course, your aunt Loretta, who I consider one of the finest examples of what human beings can be that I've ever had the privilege to meet. So I can't wait to delve into the interviews, but I want to start with the title itself, The Fight for Turtle Island, because obviously, like, you know, you chose your words very carefully and deliberately. And in the introduction, you talk a lot about war and the war mentality as, you know, being intrinsic to civilization. And so what is the semantic distinction for you between fight and war? I know it's deeper than just a merely semantical distinction, yeah, but I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, it's worth mentioning that most of the time I don't mean to, and then I find myself in the middle of conflict. So when I refer to war, I don't refer to conflict by other means. When I refer to war, I refer to the industrial destruction of human life and the ultimately functional way of thinking about humans in general. In other words, as collateral, as, filthy lucre that you get at the end of a war. And so I'm, I guess, really trying to articulate that there's like an existential difference between these ideas of a fight and a war. On the one hand, you have a series of abstractions that means that a whole bunch of people march to war. On the other hand, you have the fact that, like, we mostly experience our lives in some flux of injustice and terror that we do have the capacity to resist and to fight back. So I guess war is something that an individual person can't resist or fight back against, and a fight is something that we can. So that's one distinction.
We have a little more agency in a fight.
Sure. But you know, and it's also, I guess, that difference between being an abstraction or part of an abstraction, which is what war is, and having an individual and individuated and a story that you can tell. So why I talk about war thinking is both to talk about something that I think is an underlying assumption beneath the abstractions of civilization and technology and capitalism and all and state. And then on the other hand, it's sort of like, where's you and me?
Yeah, I think you did a good job making those distinctions clear. Something else you do discuss, though, in the introduction, you talk about requiring something truly epic to happen to live without war. And then you go on to say, whether this epic thing is called war or revolution or the total transformation of values matters little. To clear the slate, to begin again, to reset the clocks, to return to a tabula rasa seems like an obvious step. So do you think that that process would involve horrific acts, which is something that, you know, a term you used to use a lot and, you know, seem to really emphasize?
Well, I think that there's something in the retelling of that quotation that I think what I'm really talking about is the impossibility of getting from here to there. And this is something I've talked about in the context of nihilism for a long time. But it's that idea that largely comes out of revolutionary whatever in the fuck that says if we just do X, this magic thing, this horrific act, this leap of faith, whatever it is, it's basically what I would call magic. If we just do magic and if we all agree to do the same magic, then somehow we're going to get from here to there. So that was, I'm essentially trying to torture this idea that that there's an easy answer. And mostly what that looks like, you know, most of the time when people try to convince other people to do magic shit with them, you know, their ends are even more shallow and preliminary and premature than even if we just did one magic act together, we could get from here to there. Most of the time, what we're hearing people say is if you do a magic act and then we do 1,000 more, we'll get from here to there.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by magic?
Well,
I'm very intrigued by this.
Well, I'm giving the examples here. I mean, to be more blunt, since we're in a room full of anarchists, like if we just insurrectionary together harder, that's what I mean by the magic. In other words, I'm sort of using it as a shorthand for the magic thinking of social change, and that social change works in one direction. And then more pointedly, it's this idea that society is malleable. Like all of us have a definition of society that begins a long time ago, right? I mean, actually, at the time I didn't love the title of the book, Enemies of Society, but actually as time has gone by, I love the title more and more.
You gotta admit, it's a great slogan.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason why it speaks to me is because I am an enemy of society, and yet society is an abstraction that really began a long time ago. Like I think the band Society still feels like something I can understand and feel like I'm a part of. I feel like society is a little bigger than I can understand and be a part of. And actually, Bolo Bolo lives somewhere in that space, maybe in between. Maybe a Bolo already is a society. And so to me, there are these operational questions that say, if we were going to start over, what would that look like? But since we are not going to get to do that, magic thinking is what mostly is used to talk about how we're going to go back to a place where we get to control the gap between my family and the thing I can no longer control because it's too big and monstrous to do much of anything about.
So, I mean, just to clarify, when you talk about magic, you mean if we amplify and magnify our insurrectionary efforts, we can begin to manifest like the seemingly impossible? Or,
well, again, I'm not using magic as a term of liberation or inspiration, or I'm using magic as the way in which we disconnect from the otherwise strategic or tactical thinking that we would employ. I mean, I'm also not using magic as meaning the same thing as myth. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not a story that I'm telling you that happened. It's a story I'm telling you about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's what we use instead of sort of like, it's the way that we basically jump into the future if you just trust me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously that has worked. I mean, history is full of examples where that has occurred. Something else you discussed last night during your, you know, book release discussion was, and this really resonated with me, was how in many ways, or at least one component, one motivation for you doing this book was trying to reach a younger version of yourself. What do you wish was available to you as a young rebel, a young dissident, a young anarchist, a young native rebel? And, you know, as one motivation, one component of, you know, a more holistic project. And that definitely resonated with me. I mean, I feel that motivates a lot of my own activities. So, I mean, do you have more to say on that? Or?
Well, so this book is the example we're talking about at this moment. But oftentimes, when I first started doing any anarchist writing or anarchist publishing, one thing I very much thought about was, how am I doing something that would make sense to me at the age of 15?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there, for some reasons, there's something in that period, because it was prior to me calling myself an anarchist. I didn't know what that meant at that time. I had no models. And I would say, as a general rule, like, I've read my whole life. I started reading novels at the age of 5. But I didn't have the language I have for it now until the years went by, until I had all of this experience. And so how can I reach back in time and touch that person? And I think that the things that I regret the most in terms of, like, wasting a lot of time, I'm not going to say that I think that punk rock was a waste of time, but a lot of the ideas that I thought were basically aligned with anarchism within the context of the punk scene, I didn't have a language outside of that, and I really needed it.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like a lot of simplistic liberal shit got through my filters because it was in the guise of punk rock.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that some of my writing hopefully would resolve those issues to myself in hindsight.
To that extent, do you feel you succeeded with this book? I mean, with that as one of your intentions?
Yeah. No, sure, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. I mean, but the more important thing is, like, about 15 years ago, I wrote this essay called Towards an Locating an Indigenous Anarchism. And that already has resonated to the people who I wanted to reach. This is very much a type of expansion of what was happening in that essay. And in that way, like, this is a book that I would put in the hand of any young Native radical who doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about, but who you really hope figure out something to talk about. I feel like this could very much help that kid not find my answer, but find their answer.
Yeah, you mentioned last night encountering the Native youth movement, right? Mm-hmm. Tabling with that particular essay, locating in Indigenous Anarchism. Yeah. Cool. Well, something else that stood out to me when I was reading the introduction this afternoon was, you were describing 19th century anarchism, and you refer to it as a European solution to a European problem. And while I might agree with you in reference to 19th century anarchism, I know that you see it now as more than that. So what is your conception of anarchism at this point in your life? I mean, now in the 21st century, I mean, surely you don't see it as merely a European solution to a European problem, or you probably wouldn't have spent 2 years working on this book.
Actually, I would probably say I mostly would agree with that.
What?
Not, in other words, to put it more pointedly than you have, the only reason that I can see anarchism as being something different than that is because I'm arrogant enough to feel like I have a say in what anarchism looks like today. In other words, there have been tons of reasons for me to listen to people telling me to get out. Or to put it more pointedly, like, there's a consensus as to what anarchism is, and post-left anarchism, broadly speaking, says no to that. 80% of anarchists in the world who self-describe under that term still see themselves as part of a 19th century anarchism. I mean,
I wouldn't refute that.
We can quibble the numbers, but basically, like, to the extent to which I'm part of what post-left anarchism is in the 21st century, I've defined an anarchism that looks different than what we're talking about in the context of what I'm saying in the book. But like, I'm still going up to people who have a critique I agree with about anarchism and talking to them about anarchism. The only reason I can do that is because I'm arrogant enough to believe that I get to decide what anarchism is in the 21st century, and that basically I should be listened to.
I mean, on that note, I mean, do you feel like anarchism as you define it or understand it or have contributed to developing it, the manner in which you identify as an anarchist? I mean, do you feel that type of anarchism, you know, maybe we'll conveniently refer to it as post-left anarchism. I mean, do you feel it has relevance to anyone besides Europeans? I mean, anarchist thought like that isn't rooted in 19th century leftism?
The problem is that a lot of anarchists still see their role as defending the term as defined. In other words, that it in its interests is the state and capitalism and defeating the king.
Yeah.
I mean, like we have to be really careful here, because one of the problems with an anarchist going to a person from a different culture and a culture that doesn't necessarily have a self-described anarchist tradition, especially one that the person might not have ever heard of before, mm-hmm. is that you sound like an imperialist fucking prick. Because you're basically saying, let me tell you what the problems are. To a person who, for instance, might have never have had the spending money to have a computer running in front of them. Mm-hmm. So for me, this question is like, how do you intelligently connect these ideas to the life of the person you're talking to without sounding like a religious partisan? Because of course, like, I have chosen to fight for the term anarchy, anarchism, anarchist as the way in which I describe my version of liberation. But I also don't think it's going to happen during my lifetime. And so I'm basically saying, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin?
Yeah.
And of course, that seems like an idiotic conversation to have to most people. And it is. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a different entry point. And when we're talking about native stuff, by and large, really what we're talking about is like, where does pan-nativism fall apart? And why is it that we call ourselves indigenous today instead of native? And that means starting the conversation from a really different orientation, not one that an anarchist starts from.
Well, for the sake of those listening right now, mm-hmm. like, why would one choose to refer to themselves as indigenous instead of native?
I mean, the bottom line to that does have to do with an understanding of what native movements looked like and felt like in the 70s. I will tell some family member stories that are worth mentioning. So I had a cousin who moved to Minneapolis, and Minneapolis, as it turns out, is the capital of pan-Native America. It's the city in the U.S. that has the most Native Americans living in it. It actually is a big city. It has several neighborhoods that are like Indian neighborhoods, and of course, most of them are poor. My cousin Ken, he ended up staying in like a flop house, and within a week of being there was basically rousted drinking out on the streets by what essentially boiled down to the AIM version of the Guardian Angels.
Wow.
Who told him to fucking clean up his act, stop fucking around, and or they're going to kick his ass. So many people had experiences similar to my cousins, but more importantly, while on the one hand, especially from a radical perspective, AIM can do no wrong. From the inside of AIM, from the inside of Native America or the experience of Native America, AIM were basically just another group of bullies who had a different brand of bullying. And in the context of AIM in particular in the Minneapolis area, those bullies had a name and had a family and had a tradition and had a particular kind of gig or maybe even criminal enterprise that you could be involved in if you just played by their sets of rules. But obviously the anarchist criticism of all of this is really clear. Bullies are bullies, whether they're brown, red, or whatever. I guess where I want to go with that is just to sort of say that Native is another sort of way to say pan-Native. It became more important after AIM was sort of ashes, mm-hmm. cooled ashes, for people to revisit the questions that AIM brought up and not have an answer that looked like the Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, and AIM, that didn't look like the left wing of the Democratic Party, and instead looked like answers that made sense for the particular people who were answering the question. So if you were a Sioux, your answer to these questions were really different if you were Anishinaabe, mm-hmm. or if you were Chippewa, or if you were Diné. And Indigenous heads more in the direction of answering the questions as if you were a member of one of the 500 nations that existed here, and of course are mostly genocided now.
Yeah.
But Indigenous has to do with that particular, we can either answer our questions in political ways, or we can answer these questions in ways that we would identify as closer to what my grandma has to say.
Yeah.
And most people pick their grandma. Yeah.
I don't blame them. Well, it's really interesting what you're saying about Minneapolis and, the large concentration of Indigenous people in this urban area. And I think that kind of segues into something else that I noticed in your introduction that I really wanted to ask you about, because this is a very interesting question to me. You state in your introduction, while the vast majority of Indigenous people are working class, it is but a small minority who describes themselves this way. And, I wanted to ask you why. Is there a cultural component to that, or what do you see as the historical component?
I would say it's actually, this would be a question that I'd answer the same way for white people as I would for Native people. Why don't white people who are absolutely working class call themselves working class? They all call themselves middle class.
Yeah.
If you own a truck, you're middle class.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say in the case of the white working class population, of which I am a member, it's a way to deceive yourself into thinking that you're actually doing better than you are and that you're less exploited than you are. It's a way of delusionally elevating your own status within a slave system. Yeah. Okay. I was just interested if you thought there was a cultural aspect to it or a connection with colonialism or.
I mean, radicals do this thing where they play chess with people's identities. And especially in lieu when class struggle is not a real phenomenon, when there actually isn't a power that could wrest control from the owning class in the current system. Again, radicals spend time playing chess pieces with pieces that are all the same shape and form. But part of what that chess playing looks like is declaring, if only these people would unify with these people, as if any of these things are transferable, like a mathematics problem, right? When in fact, you're talking about people. By and large, in a society that's as rich as ours is, being middle class means you're fucking rich, especially on the especially on the global scale. But even on the scale of the range of the kinds of financial decisions you get to make with your life, and especially when you throw in debt and all the consequences of credit, people fucking are delusional. And can feel really big and in charge of the life that they have. But of course, it means fucking nothing at all. Mm-hmm. You know, compared to, like, when we compare the actual wealth that Jeff Bezos has to, you know, any billionaire, it really is like we cannot conceive of it.
Yeah. Any self-deluded middle class individual could be sleeping under a bridge in a month.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, you have a section. This was another section that caught my eye in the introduction. Caveats. I hate to apologize. I'm quoting you here. I am generally against it as a weak substitute for caring enough to not injure in the first place. You never used to be concerned with, like, injuring other people's feelings or insulting other people. What's going on here, Aragorn?
Actually, that's not true. I mean, my end run around identity or around the kind of apologies you have to do after the fact was always to try to edge those out by framing things in the beginning. Framing by oftentimes is an intervention in that similar way. So in the context of the caveat section, like I don't want to have to say all the time, like, you know, this is why, of course, you don't use a gendered term. This is why you try to be really sensitive in the things that you say. But as a consequence, you sound calculating and you sound careful to the extent to the exception of your point. So in particular, in that caveat section, like, I really wanted to make a couple points really clear. Like, Indigenous people is a category that actually is larger than North America. In fact, it's all over the world. And some people who have been interested in my work and my thinking have written to me from Australia and New Zealand. And I have nothing to say to them because I know very little about Native America. I'm not a scholar.
Yeah.
I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not a studier of 500 nations of people. I try to be explicit in the book about the fact that I more or less talked to about five people who are Anishinaabe because I happen to know more Anishinaabe than anyone else. And I talked to a couple people from a couple different family groups. But like, that's one of the weird things about anytime you open up these conversations. I might talk to a really friendly white guy who knows an awful lot about Chippewa, more likely Cherokee, and they will talk my ear off about all the fucking trivia that they have. The point to talking about Indigenous stuff is not to get into trivia contests with people. And there's plenty of white people who will win those with me. So I wanted to sort of like make a nod in the direction of there being a worldwide thing here, knowing that people in other parts of the world will eventually read the book. But, you know, you also don't want to sound careful and calculated with everything that you say. So...
I just
wanted to sort of like say that I noticed that there are these other things that are worth talking about, but in fact, I am a creature of context. I mostly know about Ottawa in Western Michigan. Because that's where I grew up, and most of the Indians who I've ever known in my life have been Ottawa in Western Michigan. It's also worth mentioning, and I think I get into this in the introduction, I use the word Indian. And the reason that I use the word Indian is the reason why a lot of other Native people, myself included, have a gallows type of humor. It's how do you deal with the fact that your people have been genocided other than by making sure it's in people's faces, and as funny as it possibly can be. Like, you know, in fact, of course, as we all know, Indians makes no sense at all as the name of all the people who live in North America.
Well, my next question is going to be a lot more personal, but it relates to something you do mention either in the introduction or the conclusion. And it's something you brought up last night as well when we had our discussion. But you talked about how you were raised thinking you were Native or raised in a Native context, and then you moved to the West Coast or California and were told by others that you weren't Native. Mm-hmm. Now, having had the honor and privilege of meeting some of your family, I mean, I know you to be unequivocally sure. Native. So what did you encounter when you moved to California? Who were these people trying to convince you that you weren't? Like, what did you actually experience with that?
I think the one of the points I made last night that I think is a relevant point is that if I talk too much about my personal story, I end up getting really angry. I've never been a big fan of therapy or yoga or meditation. So some of those things are really raw for me. So instead, and this is the thing I learned in California, I will talk about these things in terms of abstractions. America is still a very racial country, meaning that race is usually first or second in the ways in which you describe yourself, you know, for your dating profile, or for most of the ways in which you interact with other people. Now, obviously, most people don't end up having to talk about it because it's assumed. So the first question and the shock, both in my own life and in many of the lives I see around me, is that the assumption is that we're all the same. And so you don't talk about this particular question. But, and I'll say this, and I'll entirely speak in a positive light, what the anti-blackness discourse has really brought, especially to white radicals, is a sensibility that that their entire worldview is racist. And I, in fact, agree with that. I think that everyone that I have ever met in my life is a racist person. They come carrying racist assumptions about people who come from a different cultural background than they do. So it's been enough for me to sort of say, I come from a different cultural background, and you probably have some assumptions about it. Some are true and some are not true, but actually I don't necessarily want to talk about that with you. It's enough for you to know that I come from a different cultural background, and probably more of it is economic than it is racial, but there's a racial component too. So that's how I would safely keep myself in an abstraction, but I would nod towards anti-blackness as a way in which all of us should really think about the fact that, like, we are all racist against black people as a structural component of growing to adulthood in this particular culture. So I knew myself as a Native person because the people who I knew and the programs I was a part of, and basically, like, because I lived in a Native context until I was a teenager. But then I became a punk. And the great thing about being a punk, for better or for worse, is that, like, as othered as I was before, I got to choose this kind of othering. And so as a result, like, it felt much more like a powerful thing, in a way that sometimes being a Native is not such a powerful thing, right? It's not just about, you know, feathered headdresses and eating fry bread. Like being a punk was something I got to do every day. And I got to do with my peers, and I got laid. Whereas being Native in Western Michigan would have meant poverty and the overwhelmingness of poverty and the mediocrity of poverty and the TV being on all the time. Like, in other words, the socioeconomic reality of being an urban Indian isn't something I wanted. I didn't know that it was about poverty at the time. I only knew that later because of all the abstract learning I got later on. But that's definitely how I'd frame it now.
So, I mean, who were the people you encountered when you got to California, though, who tried to convince you you weren't Native?
Well, when I came to California, one of the first things I had to tackle was the problem of, I'll try to tell this as an abstract story. I had a very generous white family member who took me into California, and they, as soon as I got to town, basically were like, how do I get rid of you? But how do I do it in a middle-class fashion? So that meant, how do I get you into college? Mm-hmm. So immediately, you know, and over the next 6 months, I had to go through the rigmarole of what would it look like to go to college, how good were my grades, what range am I going to find myself in. Like, I didn't realize I was tracking myself for my future career and class status, but I very much was. And so part of that conversation is a conversation about blood quantum. In other words, I have a missing grandparent in my birth records, and that's because that grandparent is a Canadian Odawa Indian. So my quantum is not demonstrable because he didn't have an American birth certificate. So that meant that I wasn't going to be privy to the native stuff that I would have been otherwise if we could find him, basically. Mm-hmm. So that was like the most like bureaucratic, lock in the Lego pieces to make me a pre-middle class person. That was what that looked like. And for my white relative, she was just doing the accounting. Like she was just, you know, filling out the paperwork and typing the emails or whatever in the fuck. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was before email, but but at that same time, I was an anti-racist skinhead. And so I guess that doesn't really relate to this version of the story, but to the extent to which it did, like, there was like an expectation that the kind of conversations he wanted to have were like anti-racist conversations, which of course was fine. But an anti-racist conversation as a white person in Marin County is really different than what my experience was. Mm-hmm. Which Marin County, for people who don't know, is one of the top three most expensive counties in the U.S. and the place where I graduated high school.
It's not somewhere you want to live.
Actually, there's some place.
I'm not sure graduating high school is a desirable goal either. I encourage you to drop out, but well, you know, I guess, I mean, this is great. I mean, you just provided another really smooth segue. Something else you state in your introduction is when I refer to Indigenous in most of my conversations, I'm talking about ideas of how to live as a native in this world. So in the sense, you know, of the global diaspora caused by imperialism, colonialism, empire building, the spread of civilization, like, how would you even define native at this point? I mean, like, I think it's easier for you mm-hmm. to identify as native, but what about the rest of the displaced, you know, just mutt population and orphans of empire?
Well, so this is both sort of like a philosophical conversation and is a conversation about real living people. And one of the nice things that came through in a couple of my interviews in the book is that when I was coming up, I wouldn't say I felt like an outsider to like the native circles I was a part of, but the fact that my father was white was like a known, was something that was like out there. Yeah. Whereas many of the kids who I was with, it wasn't quite as clear. Today in those same native circles, like I went to a special native school when I was younger. It was like an after-school program. Nowadays, it's almost impossible to find a kid who's both of their parents are Indians. So that's kind of about what the question is that you're asking yourself. And it seems like that the answer to that question is that basically, like, if you're in Native circles, you're on the inside. That the people who are maybe my age now and in more of teacher roles, it's a pretty strong imperative for them to just be open. To put it differently, like, it's long since, like, genocide, we're in a post-genocide era. Like, my mom doesn't know the language. My grandparents' generation, most of them knew the language, but barely. Like, they didn't use it in daily life. They just used it at home. So, like, if you want to talk about genocide, and I've actually written about this in other places, but, like, you know, it's a couple-step process, but the language and the land are two parts of that process. So if my people are from northern Michigan, which is true, how many generations did they live there? 10? 100? Did they live there for thousands of years? I know that the answer is no to that, because Ottawa were traders. They were traveling people. By and large, that didn't mean that they lived in villages, or if they did, it was only part of the year. And since the 20th century, they've been living in sticks and, you know, stick houses. So that means that, like, to really have at this conversation, you have to talk about, like, what does cultural genocide look like? What does physical genocide look like? And the thing I talked about a lot last night, which is a common theme for me when I talk about Ottawa Indian in particular, was in the 19th century, Ottawa Indians in Michigan were given a clear choice. You either walk to Oklahoma or you pick up the cross. So that's part of cultural genocide, but it's not exactly physical genocide. So I have just two generations away, a whole bunch of full blood native people in my mix. What does it look like to go from full blood native to an urbanized population of basically entirely fractional quantum natives? And what did cable television have to do with all of this? Because I can tell you for a fact, a lot of those Indians don't talk about being Indians at all, because they've been raised by cable television. So these are really complicated questions, and they're especially complicated for radicals, and also the same radicals that are implicated by the critiques of anti-blackness, because radicals they dream of a pure people who they can point to as being good. And maybe perhaps the active agents that we need to get to a better world. Mm-hmm. But we know that none of that actually exists. Yeah.
Well, you know, last night you and I were having a private discussion, and you brought up the example that you just cited of, you know, your people being given a choice to embrace Catholicism or walk to Oklahoma. And you reference the concept of survivance in reference to that term, I believe, coined by Gerald Visoner. Like, would you be willing to elaborate on that concept? Or?
Well, it's worth mentioning that the book, The Fight for Turtle Island, came out of a project that did start in this magazine that I started for this purpose called Black Seed. Part of the goal of Black Seed is to basically to force anarchism to indigenous perspectives, whether they like it or not. And partially how this has been done has been to have these really long interviews with native anarchist people. So one of the co-editors of Black Seed and one of the people who I interviewed for the paper, his name is Dominique, and Dominique sort of like rediscovered Visoner. As it turned out, before I was a radical in the 70s, Visoner was this really prolific author who was actually like as popular as, who's that Seattle native author, Sherman Alexie? He was basically the Sherman Alexie of the 70s, but more academic. You know, Sherman Alexie is actually currently under a bit of a scandal, but if you actually go through most of those essays, like Sherman Alexie is talking about queerness, he's talking about identity, he's talking a lot about the filtering that I've been talking about in terms of the two elder generations versus ours, and popular culture and all the rest. Anyways, Sherman Alexie was very smart, is very smart about recent sort of popular topics. Well, Visoner was the same about similar topics in the 70s. So written a ton of fiction, a ton of nonfiction, and so there's a lot to say about him. My interpretation of the idea of survivance, though, are about these questions of How do we survive? Bottom line. And what are we willing to sacrifice to live? And most of those answers are sad, because what we're willing to sacrifice most of the time is just about everything. We're not, in fact, the brave people at the end of the movie, or the last to die, or perhaps the ones to get away. Most of us run away real early in the story. You know, lines of refugees, which of course currently exist all over the world, those are not like, those are the people who are trying to survive. They're exhibiting survivance in their own particular way.
Well, maybe we should stick with Vizanur here a little longer, because I think it's very relevant to your own book and everything we're discussing here. What do you think of the term or the concept of post-Indian?
This is from Wikipedia. In order to cover more general Native studies, Vizanur suggests using the term post-Indian to convey that the disparate, heterogeneous tribal cultures were unified and could be addressed en masse only by European attitudes and actions towards them. So that is, in fact, a critique of AIM. Right? Basically, AIM, following the footsteps of the Black Panthers, basically made themselves comprehensible to the European eye by turning themselves into a pan-Native organization that had discrete, articulatable political desires and goals and aims. And so this is, you know, the anarchist response to this, of course, no demands. But the way in which no demands is incomprehensible to mainstream journalists and to our culture at large speaks to the same point that Vizanur made in the 70s about being post-Indian.
Smart guy. Do you feel the term more accurately describes a colonized people and culture as well?
Dominique and I, and Black Seed in general, sort of embrace that attitude, but I'm not sure Vizanur himself would.
Yeah.
He was also a mixed person, and he was sort of trying to talk about a way in which one could be part of a culture and be on the outside of it in these sort of ways. So these are complicated conversations that I think do well to be told in fiction, more than necessarily nonfiction. Sometimes nonfiction doesn't have any lubricant, so it just cuts and cuts and cuts. I think that that's fair, but I think that the point that he was trying to make was sort of like, where do we go after the pan-Native perspective did what it did to us, which was turned us into political creatures?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I think there have been very few serious attempts, within the anarchist space to deal with the complexities of colonization and race. One of the better known attempts was Anarchist People of Color, AIPOC. Mm-hmm. So in your view, what were the successes of AIPOC, their failures, their strengths and weaknesses, and how does their overall conceptual agenda relate or contrast to the arguments you present in The Fight for Turtle Island?
Yeah. It is worth mentioning that before AIPOC, there was I did a personal zine that actually talked about some of these issues. This was in the 90s. And in response, to some extent, to my personal zine was a kid who went on to college and basically took, he wrote a zine that actually was really popular at the time. It was published, he went to Evergreen. And it was called Non-Western Anarchisms. And in fact, I interview him in the book. So, and recently they did a gender change. So it's a little complicated since the interview, but it is worth mentioning that this was sort of prior to the AIPOC moment, and then the AIPOC moment happened, which was really 2002 or actually 98 and 99. Anyways, there was a foamy mixture of people having these conversations. So I was involved in very early APOC stuff. I was part of the first Bay Area APOC group, which was called RACE. And we had these arguments because, of course, some people who were involved in the same time period were much more on the side of what today we would call like an anti-blackness perspective. And there also was a tension at the time between academic people who were going to do this for college and beyond, and those of us who were not going to do that. So it's worth mentioning that a lot of APOC argumentation would look very familiar to any conversation that people are having today about racial politics. And a lot of those people are the people who formulated the conversations. In my more partisan language, a lot of APOC people were unknowing Maoists who were just trying to figure out when the end of their anarchism was going to happen. And they were going to return to essentially Maoist cultural Marxism. Mm-hmm. One of the big figures in RACE is a person who's written a couple books that are worth flipping through. The main guy is this person named Roger White. And he represents this position well. He's very articulate, very smart. I would say that the bottom line is that a lot of, like, where the tension happened between me and other people in these groups was really about this question of, like, are we going to use our identity as a political lever that may or may not be long enough to move the things that we're trying to move, i.e. most of those people were political in a way that I am anti-political. Mm-hmm. Our group was a little different than other APOC groups because we threw dance parties, and most of like our social cachet and all the rest came through the fact that we threw dance parties. And when we ended in 2001, around the time of 9/11, because there was a general call during that time period to do political action, to do political activism, and APOC wasn't important enough, or race wasn't important enough for the particular people to continue to spend time on that when the other things and the pre-anti-war movement was really coming together.
So what is the connection you see between being anti-political and indigeneity?
Well, I mean, I would, to say it really tritely, I don't think most natives benefit from politics. I totally understand why people get involved, you know, for their particular self-interests, blah, blah, blah. But by and large, I just don't think that politics benefits especially extreme minoritarian people like natives.
I don't think that's true at all. I think it's astute, but
sure.
I don't think politics benefits any of us. In your conclusion, you know, you kind of, you know, reflect on your initial motivations for undertaking this project, yeah. You know, this 2-year project at least, right? And, you know, all these extensive interviews, and you're reflecting on that, and you write, to put this another way, I was wrong in my initial thesis, and in the face of that wrongness, I am questioning both my anarchism and my relationship to indigeneity. I mean, do you want to discuss that further?
Well, the way that I found most of the people who I interviewed was essentially through activism.
Yeah.
For me, activism is a really tortured term, even though mostly when I refer to activism, I'm referring to politics. But
activism is more than a tortured term. It's a tortured realm. But yeah.
but the point here is that I'm referring to the fact that most of the people who I interviewed ultimately are activist type people, or they're failed activists and they're sad about it or regretful about it. And so when I'm referring to indigenous in this context, I'm referring to the fact that most publicly known Native people ultimately are activists in the sense that I'm against, that I'm not. And so that's really what I'm referring to in that context. And similarly with anarchism, right? Most publicly known anarchists are some version of activist. And so this set of conversations, the set of complications around these conversations really reinforced some feelings I had about the do-gooder nature of activists and my lack of attraction to it. It's worth mentioning that my initial thesis was that anarchists and indigenous people were all that they really needed to work together was some sort of keystone that I was arrogant enough to feel like I could start to piece together. But what I really got out of the conversations that I had with the Native people was that by and large, their experience with anarchists were that they were arrogant pricks who really thought that their vision of how to make a better world was and should be the primary one. It's also worth mentioning, and this is to go back to that European manifest destiny sort of attitude, a person who I would call instrumental to my anarchism, and I'm not going to mention their name for obvious reasons once I get into this.
Is that because it's Noam Chomsky?
They basically said, and I agreed with it, and I really liked this idea for a very long time. You know, they more or less were implying something about how anarchism is a process, and that part of that process means that we're anarchists every step of the way. So the way in which that plays out ultimately is that, like, we won't use non-anarchistic methods to achieve anarchist aims. But it brings up a whole sequence of ideas that I think are really important and really central to an evolving definition of what anarchism means today and into the future. Like, we'll leave the past behind, but we want to remark on the fact that there's some historical evidence in a couple of different directions here. Ultimately, what it means is that most anarchist meetings are filled with conversations about whether or not what an activity is anarchist. And this is a place where I've totally lost the script. And I'm not going to lean so heavily and say it should be this way or this or the other way, but that way in which anarchists require ideological, moral uniformity in their thinking and their actions, there is something really wrong in there. But I don't want to call it names. I just want to sort of reflect on the fact that, like,
I feel I would benefit and understand you better if you did call it names. Plus, I'd probably be entertained by that.
Yeah. But the point is that I want to remark on the fact that this is a hard question. I think almost every baby anarchist is sort of confronted with this set of questions. And the fact that we answer it in the way that we do is why we sound crazy to a lot of people who want to be effective. But it's also what makes us not monsters. So I think that there's something important in here, but I guess I don't want to totally, like, close the door on the conversation. I want to say that it's a couple kids throwing a tantrum in a bedroom, and maybe that's okay. Mm-hmm. But that idea of, like, where does it begin and end? Where does it? Yeah. Actually, I would love to hear from the peanut gallery. There's a number of people who have just been staring at us here for a little while.
Yeah, I would love to get a glass of water.
Yeah.
Well, Obsidian did such a great job.
You can fill this with water.
Okay. I'm not Cody, by the way. Obsidian did such a great job poking and prodding. But we didn't really get into the interviews.
So yeah, much. Right.
So I guess, what was your single favorite interview in this book and why?
There is a couple form called the Anpoat Duta Collective. It's a married couple, and I didn't know half of the people in the collective. And it was amazing. They're Sioux, and they're, I believe, they're Nakota, which there is Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota. And And they talked about basically some of the activist work that they do, which is basically teaching Native kids. I mean, one of the things that was so great about it is, like, the person who I knew to have the conversation with was a person who I didn't know that well personally, but he had entered my life a couple years ago because we published this book called Anarchy Works. And I had heard, so after we published the book, I'd heard that basically there were all these problems around the book that never got resolved, which is why the original publisher did not publish it. But the author didn't tell us, and we didn't hear until after it came out. Ultimately, what we learned was that a person in the in this collective basically said that it was some honky-ass racist shit, and that it was telling stories about Natives in a way that they thought was really exploitative and appropriative. So, right, so I basically had this history with this person as an editor of the book before I saw the book, and I didn't know about it until after I'd published the book. So it was really interesting to know that, like, we basically had this thing in common, but we're on different sides of an elephant, and, you know, I was on the trunk and they were on the tail. Mm-hmm. They also, like, way more than even I do, like I can pass as a Native in certain environments because people will be like, oh, you look like my Uncle Joe or whatever in the fuck. This guy looks like a white guy. And in particular, he now, like, he's a weightlifter, so he looks like a white guy bro. And the entire conversation, as you can read the interview, is like he's deeply committed to Native stuff and to Indigenous stuff. And so we had this really intense and really crisp conversation about what that means to pass as a white guy and to be involved in Native stuff. It was spot on. It was so smart. I felt better. I felt it better as a person after, because I basically challenged him on how much he passes. And it was really, really good. It was great. So that was the interview that was the most, like, revelatory for me. It was people who were younger than me, who basically come out of the same circles as I do, from an anarchist perspective, and that they were just wicked smart. I'm really bummed, actually, that they chose to, like, call themselves different. Like this is the problem with doing any anarchist book nowadays, or just doing anything, is that people get so terrified of how it is that doxing and outing and public versus private and all that shit plays out. We had another author who I don't agree with politically, basically, at all, but I found them really refreshing in the context of the interviews. They bowed out right as we went to print. So 10% of the book is gone because this person bowed out.
Are there other interviews beyond these that didn't make it in the book? Like, is there three books worth?
There aren't. The book would be three times larger, but most of the interviews were me getting to know the people who I was talking to.
So a lot of informal stuff.
A lot of informal, yeah, like who are your, like a lot of like family stuff and like where do you come from and mm-hmm. stuff like that, yeah.
Well, I really found it fascinating the way you were distinguishing Native, Indigenous.
I do a whole thing in here where I define the terms and mm-hmm. how I try to use them consistently throughout the course mm-hmm. of the book.
And the pan-Native, politicized, almost national,
yeah,
nationalistic in a way.
It was a different time. It was a different time. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a softer.
Yes.
Even for, you know, the Black liberation struggles, I have a softer critique on these things because of the different time and because experiences I haven't gone through. But when you were describing the experience of cable television, and it made me think of the displaced feeling that everyone seems to have
yes,
at this time. And it almost seems like that's a connection that flows between these. I mean, there's a difference, but there's a feeling that of that everyone seems to have.
Yeah. Yes, of course. Alienation is a universalizing experience, mm-hmm. but this is so situationist, but mm-hmm. like, but it's universal in its alienation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, so the fact that both of us might have liked Mork and Mindy. It's not enough, Rotten. It's not
Robin
enough.
Robin Williams at his prime. He went downhill after that.
I'm just saying.
No, it's not enough on its own. But it is one spark of many sparks between people that could instigate.
Well, no, I'm trying to
projects that, I'm trying that work to, against that alienation.
I'm trying to specifically point, like, so there was a time where we were all alienated in similar ways. Mm-hmm. And then around the end of the 90s, or maybe it was even the beginning of the 90s, Budweiser would put out these commercials where they would basically use these pop cultural moments that we shared mm-hmm. as ways that sitting around the table together and laughing at the same jokes mm-hmm. made sense. Mm-hmm. What I'm actually trying to point to is how terrible those Budweiser commercials were.
Yeah, yeah.
They literally point to the thing breaking us apart as if it's a thing that does the opposite,
sure.
But it absolutely doesn't. Sure. Or it does, as long as we're buying Budweiser.
So do you see any concrete projects to move forward in this world we're in?
I would love to see two or three projects that try to do the same thing that I tried to do, uh-huh. Because they would come up with different people, different mm-hmm. results. My trip, you know, partially this was done via a motorcycle trip, where I went from the Bay Area to Victoria, or really Vancouver, and then I tried to go across. Well, I did go across the Great Plains, so up through past Minneapolis through the UP and then across to Montreal mm-hmm. and then I came back through Arizona. But I just missed 2/3 of the country mm-hmm. and different people would have different connections to people who would have different or similar things to say than the people I talked to were. Like I know that publicly there are at least another 15 fairly publicly known native anarchistic type people around who could have been interviewed. Mm-hmm. The problem is that a couple of them are academics, and I have really mixed feelings in hindsight and not in hindsight about including academics in this conversation mm-hmm. because there you give something up. I'm not sure I want to call it humanity or common sense or plain spoken way of talking about your ideas. Mm-hmm. But you give up something. It's like you have too many masters. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to see someone else do a similar kind of project
yeah.
in that way.
But speaking to different
people. Yeah, but speaking to different people.
You left out the Southeast. You didn't want to go down there.
I don't have very many connections in the Southeast. Yeah, especially natives.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'd have to go there. Connect with the radical people I know and have mm-hmm. them point me.
Yeah.
And a couple people, that was what it was like and it was good. But I'd rather it be a stronger connection than that.
So, anyone else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Obsidian.